Welcome to episode 131 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Today, we are recording on the summer solstice. So happy summer for all of you who pay attention to these things. The other important part of this day is something that Mark and I probably, because of our German heritage, are particularly interested. I remember a few years ago when I was in Germany visiting my Uncle Roland to help celebrate his golden wedding anniversary, we stopped at a farmer's stand and bought asparagus, because it was towards the end of the asparagus season. And the saying in Germany is, wenn Kirschen sind rot, ist der Spargel tot. When cherries are red, asparagus is dead. So they actually regulate the time of year that you can purchase asparagus. And usually around the summer solstice is the last day that you can buy it.
Yeah, they call it Spargelzeit, which is asparagus time. And all the restaurants have on their menu this, and it's the white asparagus because they keep burying it to keep the chlorophyll out. And so you have this asparagus and you have boiled potatoes with drawn butter, sort of a classic combination, hollandaise sauce maybe. Very tasty. So yeah, we're on the shore of Lake Michigan in the far western end of the eastern time zone. So the sun is going down around 9:30 right now, which is gives us some nice long days to enjoy up here. And also, I want to recognize we just had Juneteenth was 2 days ago, and our newest national holiday. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want all the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence. You get a great primary care reference plus a poem in your email every day. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. This week, we're going to discuss management of non-ST segment MI in frail older adults, identifying children with secondary hypertension, and RSV vaccination in pregnant women. Kate, let's learn about MI.
Yeah, so if I tell you today's study is about comparing cardiac cath to medical management in frail older adults with non-ST segment elevation MI, does anyone want to guess how the invasive strategy fares?
Like it usually does.
Yeah, exactly right. So spoilers ahead. So these Spanish investigators recruited about 170 patients, 70 years of age or older, who were admitted with NSTEMIs and had a score of at least 4 on the clinical frailty scale. So that has a range of 1 to 9 with higher scales representing greater frailty. They were randomized to either a routine invasive script strategy, so that is standard of care, for an NSTEMI with a cardiac cath within 72 hours, or to a conservative strategy of sort of aggressive medical management. Patients in the conservative group could undergo cath, could go ahead to cath if they had some specific indication for it. They were followed for a year after discharge, and the primary outcome was days alive and out of the hospital within that year, with a co-primary outcome of some kind of major ischemic cardiac event. The mean age of the study population was 86, mean frailty score of 5.1, so they hit the nail on the head in terms of frail older adults. They got what they were looking for. Although they were randomized, the conservative group had a higher proportion of men, 57% to 38%, and previous MI, 39% versus 23%, and previous intervention, some kind of PCI, 40% versus 23%. So again, we randomized to the best of our ability, but it just did not fall out this time. There were no significant differences between the two groups in either of those primary outcomes, in either days alive and out of the hospital in the first year or in MACEs. This remained true across their different analytical groups. They looked at sex, comorbidities, and a variety of other things, just no significant differences. So in this study, older adults with frailty who presented with NSTEMI, there was no differences between the groups. They were actually looking to see, they were hoping to be able to present information that conservative management might be better, that we were actually doing harm by doing early invasive strategy. And they weren't able to conclude that. Again, there were just no differences. This was studied to have some limitations. As I mentioned, there were some randomization did not quite work in this. They successfully randomized, but there were still differences between the two groups. They were actually slightly underpowered. They were hoping to randomize slightly more patients, but randomization was enrollment was ended early due to the COVID pandemic, the onset of the COVID pandemic. There was also some selection bias. One of the study physicians was the person who decided if a patient was eligible for inclusion. So that was limited to a single person, but it was also somebody who was involved in the trial. So this may not be the be-all and end-all, but an interesting study, again, that sort of confirms a lot of our existing biases about whether intervening is actually the number one thing that may work, especially in frail older adults. We may just as well give them some aspirin and some statins and sort of wait and see. Henry, any thoughts here?
Thanks, Kate. I agree this is probably not the definitive study. It was small, 170. Even if it was half of their intended size, it would still be a relatively small study. And so it should not be surprising that the randomization didn't work just by chance alone. And so this unbalanced randomization tended to make the conservative group maybe look sicker and not necessarily benefit as much. The other side to this, though, is that medications by themselves are not benign, especially in frail elders. So I think we probably need not just a bigger study, but something with longer follow-up. A year is fairly small to start to see issues related to falls and the like related to medication management. So it's intriguing, but I think I still need to stay tuned. It gives me an option in the short term to think about, but I want more data.
I'll say they were not far off of their intended sample size. They were hoping for somewhere in the neighborhood of 88 participants per group, and they wound up with about 83 and 84. So that the power was close to where they wanted to be.
You know, I got to wonder, though, when you have such large differences between men and women, previous MI, previous percutaneous intervention, I mean, these are 15 to 20% differences. That's a huge difference. And to happen each time, to stack the deck in favor of intervention, and we know that people have this interventional bias. It makes me wonder about the randomization, the concealment of allocation, whether somebody was subverting that. And I don't know these investigators, and a lot of times that is done with the best of intentions, but it isn't necessarily the best thing for the study design. But all of those stacking of the deck were in favor of intervention. We're going to make the intervention potentially look better. So I think, certainly more evidence that a less invasive approach is the preferred in this population.
And yet it was published in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Yeah, it was. Good journal. One of my faves. So Kate, you have the quiz?
I sure do. Which of the following is true regarding the Choosing Wisely campaign? A, it has expanded to include an even wider range of recommendations. B, it is no longer indexed on a single website. C, it now includes no more than 10 recommendations from each specialty society. Or D, it now includes quality adjusted life year estimates associated with each recommendation. Stay tuned for the answer.
Yeah. Thanks, Kate. That's a good one. Henry. Tell us about secondary hypertension in children and adolescents.
Yeah, so Mark, your quiz back in episode 128, just about a month ago, asked about the prevalence of secondary hypertension, and it used this study from the Rational Clinical Exam in JAMA. And so the study asks what components of the clinical history and physical and office labs can be useful in differentiating primary from secondary hypertension in children and adolescents. And we promised after the quiz that we would actually address this. So the Rational Clinical Exam series in JAMA is an intermittent feature that has they do a really nice job with regards to the searching strategies and the statistical analyses. It's generally very well done. When they applied all of the various criteria, they ended up with 30 studies, but only 23 actually presented data. Now, there are still over 4,000 children and adolescents, so a reasonable number. But the quality of the studies were generally middling, so there were some limitations in that regard. And when they looked at the data, there were some occasionally disparate findings. I'll give you a couple of examples, but generally very few things were actually useful. So, for example, if there's a family history of secondary hypertension, the likelihood ratio, the positive likelihood ratio is about 5. Okay. However, the family history of any hypertension was actually not reliable at all. Children who were under 10 percentile for age and sex in terms of their body weight, that had a positive likelihood ratio of about 4.5. On the other hand, if the child is obese, that had a positive likelihood ratio of 0.3. So meaning a positive finding was actually more associated with primary essential hypertension than secondary. Now, some interesting things with regards to symptoms, and this is where things got a little bit disparate. So, for example, symptoms associated with hypertension, and they specifically talk about headache, blurry vision, dizziness, chest pain, or edema. The absence of those symptoms essentially ruled out secondary hypertension. However, the presence of headache, either by history or it turns out that positive likelihood ratios and negative likelihood ratios were of no use whatsoever. The only lab that they found it was really restricted to a single study was microalbuminuria had a positive likelihood ratio of 13, but the negative likelihood ratio was about 1. So generally not all that useful. Some other things that we often think about, so sex, race, stage of hypertension, left ventricular hypertrophy, none of those were useful. And they also did not find much data at all about the accuracy of some of the common things that we were taught, like, you know, looking for coarctation. Do you have delayed femoral pulses, differences in blood pressure between upper and lower extremities, things of that nature. They also did not address initial treatment response. And very few of the studies used 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitoring to confirm the diagnosis. So there were a lot of limitations. And one of the common problems that they identified in the studies was this thing called workup bias, where you only look at those that have positive findings. And so I think this is basically telling us that the quality of the studies aren't great. There are very few things that we can rely on. And there are just maybe a few things that we should be looking for. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the microalbuminuria really stands out as the most important positive finding. So that would be something to get if you're considering this diagnosis in a kid. And the low body weight and family history also significantly increase the risk. I'm less impressed by the symptom data. The negative likelihood ratio of 0.2 to 0.4 roughly, I wouldn't say that rules out, the absence of symptoms. I wouldn't say it rules out. Certainly makes it less likely, for sure. But I mean, the microalbuminuria just by itself, really, at least based on that one study, really significantly increases the risk. Kate?
Yeah, I guess I'm slightly less convinced. You said one study, it was a 1% prevalence. And I'm looking at the confidence interval that you have on that between 3 and 53, which does actually make me feel less confident. I'm not sure. The question, I guess, is if I diagnose a kid with hypertension, do I do a microalbumin study on all of them in the hopes that that will help me triage which kids need, further evaluation in the absence of a family history of hypertension of any kind, which may be a better marker, and in the absence of information about their weight, if they're, kind of a kid with a normal weight.
Well, if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations for the workup of children with secondary hypertension, I think a microalbuminuria, it's painless and relatively cheap compared to the low yield of all of the other stuff that they do that involves a blood poke on a kid.
Yeah, what's missing, though, is the number of medications. So if a kid has diagnosed with hypertension, you put them on one drug at a moderate dose and they're controlled, versus a kid that isn't controlled with 2 or 3 drugs. It seems like that, I don't know, but it seems like that would be another kind of red flag, and that wasn't discussed here, I guess.
Yep.
All right. I guess I'm up with some new vaccine information. So this is by Campman and colleagues in the New England Journal, bivalent pre-fusion F vaccine in pregnancy to prevent RSV illness in infants. So there was a pretty bad RSV season in 2022-2023. This study, timing is everything. There's several new RSV vaccines being proposed to the FDA. This Pfizer-sponsored study evaluated a new RSV vaccine in pregnant women. The women were healthy. They got the immunization or placebo injection between 24 and 36 weeks gestation. There were a total of 7,392 women, of whom 7,148, so almost all of them, gave birth. At baseline, their average age was 29 years. The mean gestational age when they got their vaccine was 31 weeks. Groups were similar at randomization. They didn't say whether the analysis was per protocol or by intention to treat, which is important because the retention in the trial was only fair. Only about 80% were still enrolled at 6 months. This was described in the paper as an interim analysis, so hopefully we'll be seeing the final analysis with better follow-up, you know, perhaps at another publication. So at 6 months after birth, the likelihood of having a medically attended, so needing to see the doctor, severe RSV was significantly lower in the vaccine group, 0.5 versus 1.8%, so number needed to treat of 81. Likelihood of any medically attended RSV, lower RTI, was also lower in the vaccine group at 6 months, 1.6 versus 3.4%. Again, number needed to treat of about 60. Vaccine efficacy was estimated based on these data to be 67% for RSV hospitalization. Local reactions were common in the vaccine group, 41 versus 10%, muscle pain, 27 versus 17%. There were no differences in, or at least significant differences in maternal or neonatal outcomes beyond RSV, although there were 5 infant deaths in the vaccine group and 12 in the placebo group, but this wasn't statistically significant. A bivalent RSV vaccine given to pregnant women, therefore, between 24 and 36 weeks, safely reduces the likelihood of severe RSV with an NNT of about 81. Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably accept this as a patient, given how catastrophic severe RSV can be, and also because at 31 weeks, or it sounds like they may indicate it, or they may recommend it as early as 24, you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, sometimes it can be very difficult to predict preterm birth, and so obviously the earlier you deliver, the riskier RSV can be in a baby, and so I can see this obviously getting wide uptake. I would want to know a little bit more about some of the outcomes. So medically attended severe RSV, whether that was an office visit versus, obviously, I would like to know even more that we can prevent some of those worse outcomes. And I'm guessing, obviously, as we get more information, we'll get a better sense of how effective is it at preventing mortality from RSV. But based on this alone, I think I'm probably on.
Henry?
I agree that this is probably a good group to be targeting, especially as you point out, RSV in those kids less than 6 months of age, preemies, kids with congenital heart disease, things of that nature can be catastrophic. So, you know, stepping back though, as Mark pointed out, we're now seeing Magic Johnson promoting a new RSV vaccine for the elderly, you know, targeting the 60, 65 and older group. We've got a whole bunch of vaccines out there that I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but, you know, I start to question why do we vaccinate against hepatitis A, for example, or other conditions that are largely trivial kinds of things that have very rare long-term consequences and the like? And so, you know, I wonder about at what level is the burden of suffering and the nature of the burdens for us to be investing huge amounts of money to vaccinate people against illnesses that don't cause much difficulty. Again, not this particular group, but stepping back and looking at some of the other initiatives. Could we be better expending those dollars on other things like access to good care?
Yeah, and our health system is not necessarily set up to spend money the most wise way possible on things, right? It's set up to make the most money for the most people who are delivering care. Cynically, he said cynically. And, you know, there is also another study, I think it was actually in the same issue of the New England Journal that I wrote up on the vaccine for the elderly, the Magic, what we'll now be calling the Magic Johnson vaccine, apparently, who's from East Lansing, where Henry and I both worked. And that one had a much less impressive number needed to treat, I thought, in terms of, you know, moderately severe RSV. No impact on mortality, if I remember correctly. So it was much less impressive. I was much more impressed by this vaccine in this population and the potential benefit. So, yeah.
And yet the vaccine targeted to the elders, the commercials, is the person having the conversation and you see the EKG going and all of a sudden flatline. So,
Henry, I'm not sure how to tell you this. I've never seen this commercial.
Oh my gosh.
You don't watch enough golf, apparently. They know their target audience. Okay, Kate, we got a quiz answer for us.
I do. It's actually on the same subject of high value care. Which of the following, the question again was, which of the following is true regarding the Choosing Wisely campaign? Has it expanded to include more recommendations? Is it no longer indexed? Does it include fewer recommendations from each specialty society? Or does it now include qualies with each recommendation? So unfortunately, the correct answer is B. Since inception in 2012, all of the Choosing Wisely recommendations had been collated on the ABIM Foundation website. But effective earlier this year, the ABIM Foundation has stopped doing this. The recommendations are now available through each specialty society's individual web page or their publication format. The program grew from fewer than 10 specialty societies to more than 70 with more than 800 recommendations. So I guess it got out of hand. I will mention, I can't find a way to quickly search all the Choosing Wisely recommendations anymore. So if anybody does know how to do this, please let me know. I made good use of that website while it was still active.
Henry, sounds like a retirement project for you.
There you go.
Create a new website. How hard is it to maintain a website? That kills me. I mean, really?
I mean, come on. You know,
ABIM, it's not that hard. I maintain a couple of websites, please.
So, you know, in April, mid to late April, I gave a talk in Texas about the top 20 poems of 2022, and they wanted me to also make mention of the Choosing Wisely campaign. And so just a week or so before, so this is now within 2 months, the website actually had all of that information, lots of educational resources. They even had an app that would run on Apple-based products, but not necessarily Android. So they had a lot of resources that were available that are no longer there, because I just visited it yesterday, and it's been just within the last 2 months that they made this decision. So hopefully they might revisit that. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark.
No, go ahead, Henry.
Well, the other part to this is that it allows us to remember, and so there's this secondary trivia question. Who instigated this Choosing Wisely campaign? Was it a politician? Was it a bunch of healthcare economists, trauma surgeons, a small business consortium? No, none of the above. It was a family physician, our friend and colleague, Howard Brody, who was at MSU, but he was at UTMB when he wrote this commentary in 2010 in the New England Journal. And he challenged specialty societies, just take the top five diagnostic tests or treatments where they're expensive and the current evidence suggests that they are ineffective, and to make that as their limited campaign. And since that time, it's really taken hold. It was the basis of the Choosing Wisely campaign, and it has expanded, unfortunately, to the point where maybe one specialty society can no longer handle it.
Well, I will say that the recommendations, I think, are generally quite sound. I do think the way they present them, or the sort of evidentiary basis for each recommendation, is often kind of lacking or inconsistent. They might cite a study or two kind of randomly and say, here's why it doesn't work. It's not really based on the highest level of systematic reviews or evidence. But, you know, as I said, I generally agree, and they're pretty low-hanging fruit. You know, if radiologists are telling you not to do something, you really probably shouldn't be doing it since it makes them money. I think it's too bad we can't find it in one place.
Yeah, they aren't meant to be, you know, they're not guidelines. They're meant to be things to provoke conversations.
That's a good point. That's a great point, Kate. Thanks. Yep. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening, and please go to online IAFP education webpage at iafp.com if you want to get CME credit. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, rate us on Apple Podcast app and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.